Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello and welcome to Bookworm. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and today my guest is Amy Gerstler. Her most recent book of poems, Medicine, has recently come out from Penguin, as are available Crown of Weeds and Nerve Storm. Carnegie Mellon University Press has reissued an earlier book, Bitter Angel, and so she is in the happy position as a poet of having a good deal of her work available. In order to leap right in, I thought I would ask Amy to read the first poem in her book, Medicine, which is a kind of specialty of hers. Among my favorite poems of hers are these articulations to babies, and this is called Prayer for Jackson. Amy Gerstler.
Prayer for Jackson. Dear Lord, fire-eating custodian of my soul, author of Hermaphrodites, Radishes, and Arizona's Rosy Sandstone, please protect this wet-cheeked baby from disabling griefs. Help him sense when to rise to his feet and make his desires known, and when to hit the proverbial dirt. On nights it pleases thee to keep him sleepless. Summon crickets, frogs, and your chorus of nocturnal birds, so he won't conclude the earth's gone mute. Make him astute as Egyptian labyrinths that keep the dead's privacy inviolate. Give him his mother's swimming ability. Make him so charismatic that even pigeons flirt with him in their nervous avian way. Grant him the clear-mindedness of a midwife who never winces when tickled. Let him be adventurous as a menu of ox-tongue hash, lemon-rind wine, and pinecone jello. Fill him with awe for the seasons, minarets, saw-toothed peaks, the breathing of cathedrals, and all that lives, for one radiant day or 60 pitiful years. Bravely he has ventured among us, disguised as a newcomer, shedding remarkably few tears.
Amy Gerstler, reading the first poem in her book, Medicine, Prayer for Jackson. Now, that poem is followed by a poem called To a Woman in a Coma, and the poem after it is a invocation to a ghost. And I wanted to ask you about this propensity to address creatures and beings who can't talk back to you.
I guess if you're addressing someone who can't talk back, you can talk as long as you want. Well, let's see. I think there's a little bit of a parallel there, too, just in terms of the predicament of the writer, because in a way you're always addressing someone who can't talk back to you, which is the reader, whoever that might be, singular or plural. Also, I'm interested in the idea that poetry is useful, and that its history of having come from incantations and spells and chants to make your enemies burn to a crisp or make someone be able to have a baby or something like that. I like that idea, fallacious as it may be, that there's so much power in words.
Now, the new book, Medicine, is full of sorrow. In fact, I think, although the subjects of death and sickness have been many times engaged by your work, these poems seem incapable of avoiding the subject. The poems will drift that way almost unwillingly. And I wondered what it was like to write a book that I think engages its subjects more directly than the other ones do.
Well, this book comes out of a kind of funny predicament for me, because as a person, I think that I've always had kind of a melancholy temperament or a sort of morbid cheerfulness or something like that. But up until the time that I was writing this book, I think that I'd mostly led a sort of happy life, and so the melancholy was fancy and imaginings and based on reading I'd done and, you know, feeling sorry for myself or taking a long time with my adolescence or something. During the time that I was writing this book, I had sort of real events occur in my life that were grief-producing. I had a younger brother who died. My husband's mother died, and a student of my husband's and mine was severely injured in a skiing accident and went into a coma and died, and that's who the sort of a poem to wake somebody up from a coma is addressed to. So I sort of had to deal with the real aspects of stuff that I'd been imagining all along. And it's different.
You're listening to Bookworm. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and we're talking to poet Amy Gerstler, whose most recent book, Medicine, is available in paperback from Penguin, A Happy Situation, which we should be celebrating. Now, I would like to ask you to read a somewhat longer poem that gets, in its way, deeper and deeper into the subject of death, even though it's done, it's taken as its occasion, the walking of a dog. The poem is called July 3rd, and it is from the collection Medicine by my guest Amy Gerstler.
July 3rd. Overcast till 4 p.m. Gunshot-like crackling punctuates the hazy afternoon. Premature fireworks as neighbors prepare ear-splitting festivities in honor of Independence Day. Bees big as doorknobs buzz drunkenly by, barely able to remain airborne. The dog races ahead through Elysian Park. We're on a dirt trail that winds through California scrub, scorched hillsides of orange nasturtiums, morning glories colonizing small trees, trunks unreadably graffitied in blue. Blooming yellow anise, pepper trees, and parched jade plants. Scrolled white jimson flowers jut up, ready to unfurl like small torahs and reveal their stern laws. Eat me at your peril, heedless vision seeker, hungry infidel. My beloved short-legged dog has something suspicious between her teeth. I can tell by the way she's holding it, I'm going to have to take it away from her. It's some kind of contraband. She's thrilled with her discovery, wants to eat whatever it is right away. I have to tell her, drop that, 4 or 5 times in a fake stern voice before she obeys. It's a rodent torso, a baby gopher or ground squirrel from the waist up, tiny front limbs all drawn in at the elbows, and the delicate claws resemble a wren's. Its straight yellow buck teeth form the perfect gardening tool, extending past the end of its whiskered chin. The poor half-gopher's all dried out by our desert weather. And I'm being mean to deny the dog her treat, her fur-covered meat prune. I tell myself I'm worried about what the gopher died of. Maybe it'd make the dog sick. Though most likely the rodent's life ended from being chewed in two. Rather than some imagined mammal plague, I fret could harm my hound. She regards me for a moment with tolerant disdain, then trots off to sniff a beetle. Black as a bobby pin, its shellacked butt, for some reason, mating stance, insect religion, is thrust up in the air. I follow the dog, convinced of her superior wisdom. She paws a puckered patch of mud, almost tromps on a woolly caterpillar. Another firecracker whistles and booms. She'll take on rattlesnakes or pit bulls without hesitation, but really fears these explosions. Last 4th of July, skyrocket noises got her so riled, she chewed the wooden blinds to splinters and gnawed off part of a table leg. When I returned from barbecuing, I found her crammed under my desk, shivering. Normally, she's so stoic. A book I've only read parts of says that in Greece, around 300 BC, the Stoics believed nothing could happen which was not part of nature's perfection. Man's duty was to cheerfully accept whatever occurred, secure in the knowledge it was all for the best. If you traveled to Egypt and a Nile crocodile bit your firstborn in twain, or the oracle at Delphi prophesied ruin for you and your issue, or your daughter got leprosy, or your son was enslaved and made to wait upon foreign heads of state naked, or your wife ran off with 5 illiterate monks you'd paid to stomp your grapes into wine, you were supposed to remain calm, unmoved by good fortune or bad, beyond hope or fear. After you died, little brother, people offered condolences. Since you're with me now every second, you accompany the dog and me on this hike. Sometimes, to be kind, friends suggested that since you'd been so ill, maybe it was better you'd passed into infinity, where out-of-the-body adventures commence. Maybe it was for the best, they said. You'd graduated to ash, and thus your sufferings had ended. I admire those Stoics. Truly I do. Their attempt to relish every strange fate the earth serves up, their faith in nature, that seizure-prone, sexy, bloodthirsty girl. I comb the dog's fur with my fingers, picking out foxtails. I find a clod of dirt sprouting 9 kinds of grass and give it a kick. When a lifetime finishes, proteins fold themselves into useful shapes, like clothes neatly stored in drawers for future use. Then, the devout, clannish Stoics clap their non-existent hands, and the applause is just deafening. Bravo, they yell, jumping up and down. They pound the red velvet arms of their chairs, wad up their programs, and pelt the stage with them. More, 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 they chant, faces hot, eyes brimming. Let us hurtle through the world again. We demand an encore.
Amy Gerstler, reading July 3rd. Now, I've always been amazed in your poems by the emergence of something like in this one, the dog's fur-covered meat prune. What a funny way to describe something the dog has found that he shouldn't eat.
It was pretty damn funny looking.
But it's always struck me that those furry caterpillars and those bemused and beautiful descriptions of nature are a kind of stoicism, a kind of way of making the best of a situation by turning it into amusing language or surprising bouquets of startling phrases.
I like the idea of stoicism. I like the idea of trying to make the best of your moments on earth. We don't really have any other choice. I just found that as sort of a human being, when my brother died, suddenly the same things that I had said to comfort other people, like that remark that people would make to me about, oh, he was so sick, so this is really for the best. I'd said that to people before in the past and meant it and felt it, and I understood the goodness of their intentions and the rightness of what they were saying, but I wanted to punch them in the face. Not because they were wrong, just because I was so unhappy and because it was so hard to have to take my own medicine, so to speak, mm-hmm. in the form of that kind of advice. I didn't want to be comforted yet, and I didn't want to be stoic, and I didn't want to accept the fact that he was dead and that was an okay part of nature. I suddenly drew the line, and I suddenly went around saying things like, you know, this mortality thing, it sucks. I want a different system. I'm not into it anymore. I think just that flare-up of resistance against something that I think is right but hard to swallow mm-hmm. when it comes down to it.
Now, the dog takes you on a walk in another poem, and I began to think, is this, you know, sort of a cerebral, what is that dog in hell called?
Oh, Cerberus?
Yeah.
No, she's only got one head.
But,
at least
but,
that I can see.
But she seems to have something of a propulsion toward instances of mortality.
Well, I always wanted a dog, and I have one for the first time in my life, and I've had her for 10 years. And there's this obnoxious thing where people who are married call someone who they're married to their better half.
Uh-huh.
And I don't like it when married couples do it, but I really do think the dog is my better half in lots of ways. And I think if you... this will be meaningless to people who don't like dogs, but I think that if you have dogs and love them, one of many things they can do for you is that they do pull you out into nature. They make you take walks, and they are, I think, more sort of directly in touch with nature than we are, at least than I am. And I consider that a blessing and a big favor, and that does bring you closer to things like life and death. I mean, I watch her eat bones. That's one thing that dogs do, is reduce bones. You know, when other animals have taken care of the meat, they do everyone the favor of bringing the bones back down to
pulp.
dust, nothing, or recycling them through their bodies. And it's, I think she's a sweet, kind animal, but, you know, I'm a vegetarian, and to see her attack a bone with such adoration and gusto is weird and interesting.
Well, I notice also that in your poems, animals frequently are the guides to another realm, and that a lot of your poems involve a translation between this world and some other one, whether that's a natural one or heaven or hell. But frequently, you know, just going back to your sense of poetry as incantation or as spell, these animal figures and many others, a broom in medicine that gets invoked, seem to act as sort of like spirit guides to other, you know, other orders of existence. I know unconsciously, but nevertheless, that does seem to be part of the witchcraft of the poems.
I think that's really true. I'm afraid I'm a bit inside of a sort of weird, superstitious, primitive animist or something, and so I've never kind of completely been able to get over that idea in some small part of my brain that everything is alive and has a soul, you know, the microphones we're talking into, or your Coke over there, or the dog. I do think animals have souls. You know, I believe in sentient beings and all that. So, yeah, I think that's true.
I wanted to ask you, because there is in the book an entirely different kind of poem that's almost been released into the realm of pure pleasure. These are the poems of language play, word play, rhyme play, and whereas before they were often caught between worlds, between the pleasure of nonsense and the pain of a kind of stabbing or anguished recognition, here they seem to be almost gravityless, as if there's no way to call them back to earth. Let's hear one of them and then talk about the kind of poem that doesn't have an earthly concern in the world. I'm going to ask you to read, well, my favorite of these crazy ones, The Story of Toasted Cheese.
Okay, here it is. The Story of Toasted Cheese. This has a proverb as an epigraph, and the proverb, which is a real proverb, says, "Toasted cheese hath no master." Toasted cheese hath no master. Streams of priests running from pink bungalows faster and faster were seen reading the fronds of God, prophesying disaster. Indoors, toddlers munched crumbs of ancient wall plaster. You slapped her for calling Dad a majestic bastard? At the mouth of a sacred cave, kneeling in gravel, he asked her. The ostrich race will take place in that picturesque cow pasture. Will you have the oysters Rockefeller to begin your repast, sir? Her premonition consisted of seeing her dear sister romanced by a sandblaster. Monique loved the rough, comforting hum of that scruffy black cat's purr. the botanist finally recognized, tears filling her overworked eyes, a rare blue Chinese aster.
Amy Gerstler, reading the story of toasted cheese.
For the first time on radio.
tell me how a poem like that takes its shape, comes about, gets continued. I'm charmed by it, but completely bewildered.
It is a poem that grew out of bewilderment, so that's entirely appropriate, I think. I have this old 1920s or 30s book of Putnam's quotations, and I like old reference books, and this book of quotations is particularly nice, and it has a lot of strange old proverbs in it, and I do research in it from time to time. I was actually hired to do research by the artist Alexis Smith about things about food for something she was doing for the Getty, and I came across this, which she couldn't use, but I was unable to forget, because what does that mean? Toasted cheese hath no master? I thought about it all night. So I decided to try and write a poem where every line rhymed with that line, or every few lines rhymed with that line, in an attempt to kind of, not really a serious attempt, but a sort of zany, playful attempt to at least come to terms with this weird proverb, or bounce things off of it until it took some kind of other shape and I comprehended it. I've never comprehended it, but I think it's extremely lovely and funny.
Oh, and it's a lovely and funny poem, too.
Thank you.
But I wondered, is it sometimes the case, because I know that your poems are very conscious. When you read them in book, when I read them, the recurrence of certain motifs, a certain willlessness, as if the poem is a boat being blown in a direction that's now taking it over, so that like the dog dragging you to the dead gopher, you're handling a subject that you might not want to handle in the public space of a poem. And I began to get the idea that these poems in particular might be the kind of medicine of gaiety to ward off, through nonsense, through meaninglessness, the danger of significance or the danger of grief.
I don't know if I completely believe in meaninglessness. I think even... like, I like Edward Lear and stuff like
me
that.
Too. Yeah.
And I find that, I think there's a difference between, like, nonsense and nonsense poetry and meaninglessness. Because I think nonsense does have a meaning, even if it's more of a sort of a physical meaning than a cerebral meaning, in terms of pleasure and the delight of rhyme and sound and... it's like eating something, like a kind of a confection, as opposed to maybe some other kind of more nutritious meal. But I don't know if I think that nonsense rhyme, when it's good, is actually meaningless.
I sensed here, and this is in a way my final question, that there's a world of kind of simultaneous sadness and surprise that these poems, when they're at their best, is capable of incorporating, you know, the two into one poem, but almost as if in this book there's an exploration of the division between sadness and diversion, and that getting a little bit closer to the core of unhappiness, naming it, which you don't really do in any of the previous books. All the critics have always said, which of these voices is Amy's? And these are poems that seem to offer riddling clues to the nature of Amy Gerstler. But here you're pretty much addressing the death of a brother, the death of a mother-in-law. There's a much more open availability of the speaker than there has been before. And I wondered what that was like.
I think... they are a sort of an attempt to grapple with, because when something really bad happens, then you are surprised that, A, the world goes on, and B, you survive it if you do, and C, that you can be happy again, or that there is diversion, that you can want to still make rhymes. Sometimes you feel like a traitor for being able to be happy after pain or loss, but there's also something wonderful and shocking and weird and surprising about everything continuing as before.
By the end of this book, a fullness of the sense of, like, captivity, grief, and death makes the book really touching and sad in ways that I hadn't experienced your work being before. And I just wondered, since it does proceed by small hints or titrated droplets, were you tiptoeing into that kind of personal realm that the work really hadn't engaged before?
I have lots of issues as a writer and as a person about privacy. And I think that poems have a really interesting relationship to privacy because they can seem, and I've been fascinated by the way poems and a lot of literature can seem really revelatory, really confessional, but at the same time, you know, it's marks on paper and there's a lot of privacy. And I'm attracted to both things, the kind of private and the mysterious and the what's confessed and sobbingly told out or laughingly
or
told out. Or right, or just plain old withheld.
Is this book more revealing than you meant it to be?
Oh, you ask such good, hard questions. Because I'm timid about revelation, maybe a bit, but it's hard to tell because a thing that always happens to me is things that I write that I think are really autobiographical and really revealing, people are always convinced I've made them up. And then other things that I have made up, like I had a guy accost me at a reading once after I read a poem about naming a daughter. And he didn't, he said, oh yes, naming kids, it's so hard. And I said, well, yeah, whatever. And he said, how many kids do you have? And I said, I don't have any children, actually, that was, you know, made up. And he refused to believe me and got quite angry at me because he thought I was lying to him. So I think that's really interesting, too. I think the book probably... I guess I'll plead the fifth. Like, I don't want to reveal whether I think it's too revealing or not. That should tell you all you need to know about me.
I've been speaking to Amy Gerstler. Her new book, published by Penguin, is Medicine. Thank you very much for joining me today, Amy.
It was fun. Thank you, Michael.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Mario Diaz. Special production assistance from Alan Howard with J.C. Swadek. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica. Cassette copies of this and other Bookworm programs are available. For ordering information, call KCRW at 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and say, books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's book of the mouse. Wow.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.